food to be cooked and dishes washed, hogs and chickens to be fed and eggs gathered. The cow had to be milked and pastured near the swamp, and someone had to watch her all day for fear the Yankees or Frank Kennedy's men would return and take her. Even little Wade had his duties. Every morning he went out importantly with a basket to pick up twigs and chips to start the fires with. It was the Fontaine boys, the first of the county men home from the war, who brought the news of the surrender. Alex, who still had boots, was walking, and Tony, barefooted, was riding on the bare back of a mule. Tony always managed to get the best of things in that family. They were swarthier than ever from 4 years' exposure to sun and storm, thinner, more wiry, and the wild black beards they brought back from the war made them seem like strangers. On their way to Mimosa and eager for home, they only stopped a moment at Terra to kiss the girls and give them news of the surrender. It was all over, they said, all finished, and they didn't seem to care much or want to talk about it. All they wanted to know was whether Mimosa had been burned. On the way south from Atlanta, they had passed chimney after chimney where the homes of friends had stood, and it seemed almost too much to hope that their own house had been spared. They sighed with relief at the welcome news and laughed, slapping their thighs when Scarlett told them of Sally's wild ride and how neatly she had cleared their hedge. "She's a spunky girl," said Tony, "and it's rotten luck for her, Joe getting killed." "You all got any chewing tobacco, Scarlett?"
"Nothing but rabbit tobacco. Pa smokes it in a corn cob."
"I haven't fallen that low yet," said Tony. "But I'll probably come to it."
"Is Dimity Monroe all right?" asked Alex, eagerly but a little embarrassed. And Scarlett recalled vaguely that he had been sweet on Sally's younger sister.
"Oh, yes. She's living with her aunt over in Fayetteville now. You know their house in Lovejoy was burned, and the rest of her folks are in Macon."
"What he means is, has Dimity married some brave colonel in the Home Guard?" jeered Tony, and Alex turned furious eyes upon him.
"Of course she isn't married," said Scarlett, amused.
"Maybe it would be better if she had," said Alex gloomily. "How the hell—" "I beg your pardon, Scarlett.
But how can a man ask a girl to marry him when his darkies are all freed and his stock gone and he hasn't got a cent in his pockets?" "You know that wouldn't bother Dimity," said Scarlett. She could afford to be loyal to Dimity and say nice things about her, for Alex Fontaine had never been one of her own beaux.
"Hell's afire. Well, I beg your pardon again. I'll have to quit swearing or Grandma will sure tan my hide. I'm not asking any girl to marry a pauper. It mightn't bother her, but it would bother me."
While Scarlett talked to the boys on the front porch, Melanie, Sue Ellen, and Corrine slipped silently into the house as soon as they heard the news of the surrender. After the boys had gone, cutting across the back fields of Tara toward home, Scarlett went inside and heard the girls sobbing together on the sofa in Ellen's little office. It was all over. The bright, beautiful dream they had loved and hoped for, the cause which had taken their friends, lovers, husbands, and beggared their families. The cause they had thought could never fall had fallen forever. But for Scarlett, there were no tears. In the first moment, when she heard the news, she thought, "Thank God, now the cow won't be stolen. Now the horse is safe. Now we can take the silver out of the well, and everybody can have a knife and fork. Now I won't be afraid to drive round the country looking for something to eat." What a relief! Never again would she start in fear at the sound of hooves. Never again would she wake in the dark nights, holding her breath to listen, wondering if it were reality or only a dream that she heard in the yard, the rattle of bits, the stamping of hooves, and the harsh crying of orders by the Yankees. And best of all, Tara was safe. Now her worst nightmare would never come true. Now she would never have to stand on the lawn and see smoke billowing from the beloved house and hear the roar of flames as the roof fell in. Yes, the cause was dead, but war had always seemed foolish to her, and peace was better. She had never stood starry-eyed when the stars and bars ran up a pole or felt cold chills when Dixie sounded. She had not been sustained through privations, the sickening duties of nursing, the fears of the siege and the hunger of the last few months, by the fanatic glow which made all these things endurable to others, if only the cause prospered. It was all over and done with, and she was not going to cry about it. All over. The war which had seemed so endless, the war which, unbidden and unwanted, had cut her life in two, had made so clean a cleavage that it was difficult to remember those other carefree days. She could look back, unmoved, at the pretty scarlet with her fragile green morocco slippers and her flounces fragrant with lavender. But she wondered if she could be that same girl. Scarlet O'Hara, with a county at her feet, 100 slaves to do her bidding, the wealth of Tara like a wall behind her, and doting parents anxious to grant any desire of her heart. Spoiled, careless Scarlet, who had never known an ungratified wish except where Ashley was concerned. Somewhere, on the long road that wound through those 4 years, the girl with her sachet and dancing slippers had slipped away, and there was left a woman with sharp green eyes who counted pennies and turned her hands to many menial tasks. A woman to whom nothing was left from the wreckage except the indestructible red earth on which she stood. As she stood in the hall, listening to the girl's sobbing, her mind was busy. "We'll plant more cotton, lots more. I'll send pork to Macon tomorrow to buy more seed. Now the Yankees won't burn it, and our troops won't need it. Good Lord, cotton ought to go sky high this fall." She went into the little office, and disregarding the weeping girls on the sofa, seated herself at the secretary and picked up a quill to balance the cost of more cotton seed against her remaining cash. "The war is over," she thought. And suddenly she dropped the quill as a wild happiness flooded her. The war was over, and Ashley, if Ashley was alive, he'd be coming home. She wondered if Melanie, in the midst of mourning for the lost cause, had thought of this. "Soon we'll get a letter. No, not a letter. We can't get letters, but soon. Oh, somehow he'll let us know." But the days passed into weeks, and there was no news from Ashley. The mail service in the South was uncertain, and in the rural districts there was none at all. Occasionally, a passing traveller from Atlanta brought a note from Aunt Pitty, tearfully begging the girls to come back. But never news of Ashley. After the surrender, an ever-present feud over the horse smoldered between Scarlet and Sue Ellen. Now that there was no danger of Yankees, Sue Ellen wanted to go calling on the neighbors. Lonely and missing the happy sociability of the old days, Sue Ellen longed to visit friends, if for no other reason than to assure herself that the rest of the county was as bad off as Tara. But Scarlet was adamant. The horse was for work. To drag logs from the woods, to plow, and for pork to ride in search of food. On Sundays he had earned the right to graze in the pasture and rest. If Sue Ellen wanted to go visiting, she could go afoot. Before the last year, Sue Ellen had never walked 100 yards in her life, and this prospect was anything but pleasing. So she stayed at home, and nagged, and cried, and said once too often, "Oh, if only Mother was here!"
At that, Scarlet gave her the long-promised slap, hitting her so hard it knocked her screaming to the bed and caused great consternation throughout the house. Thereafter, Sue Ellen whined the less, at least in Scarlet's presence. Scarlet spoke truthfully when she said she wanted the horse to rest, but that was only half of the truth. The other half was that she had paid one round of calls on the county in the first month after the surrender, and the sight of old friends and old plantations had shaken her courage more than she liked to admit. The Fontaines had fared best of any, thanks to Sally's hard ride, but it was flourishing only by comparison with the desperate situation of the other neighbors. Grandma Fontaine had never completely recovered from the heart attack she had the day she led the others in beating out the flames and saving the house. Old Dr. Fontaine was convalescing slowly from an amputated arm. Alex and Tony were turning awkward hands to plows and hoe handles. They leaned over the fence rail to shake hands with Scarlet when she called, and they laughed at her rickety wagon, their black eyes bitter, for they were laughing at themselves as well as her. She asked to buy seed corn from them, and they promised it, and fell to discussing farm problems. They had 12 chickens, 2 cows, 5 hogs, and the mule they brought home from the war. One of the hogs had just died, and they were worried about losing the others. At hearing such serious words about hogs from these ex-dandies who had never given life a more serious thought than which cravat was most fashionable, Scarlet laughed. And this time her laugh was bitter, too. They had all made her welcome at Mimosa, and had insisted on giving, not selling her, the seed corn. The quick Fontaine tempers flared when she put a greenback on the table, and they flatly refused payment. Scarlet took the corn and privately slipped a dollar bill into Sally's hand. Sally looked like a different person from the girl who had greeted her 8 months before, when Scarlet first came home to Tara. Then she had been pale and sad, but there had been a buoyancy about her. Now that buoyancy had gone, as if the surrender had taken all hope from her. "Scarlet," she whispered as she clutched the bill, "what was the good of it all? Why did we ever fight? Oh, my poor Joe. Oh, my poor baby." "I don't know why we fought, and I don't care," said Scarlet. "And I'm not interested. I never was interested. War is a man's business, not a woman's. All I'm interested in now is a good cotton crop. Now take this dollar and buy little Joe a dress. God knows he needs it. I'm not going to rob you of your corn for all Alex and Tony's politeness." The boys followed her to the wagon and assisted her in, courtly for all their rags, gay with a volatile Fontaine gaiety, but with a picture of their destitution in her eyes. She shivered as she drove away from Mimosa. She was so tired of poverty and pinching. What a pleasure it would be to know people who were rich and not worried as to where the next meal was coming from. Kate Calvert was at home at Pinebloom, and as Scarlet came up the steps of the old house in which she had danced so often in happier days, she saw that death was in his face. He was emaciated, and he coughed as he lay in an easy chair in the sunshine with a shawl across his knees. But his face lit up when he saw her. Just a little cold which had settled in his chest, he said, trying to rise to greet her. Got it from sleeping so much in the rain. But it would be gone soon, and then he'd lend a hand in the work. Kathleen Calvert, who came out of the house at the sound of voices, met Scarlet's eyes above her brother's head, and in them Scarlet read knowledge and bitter despair. Cade might not know, but Kathleen knew. Pinebloom looked straggly and overgrown with weeds. Seedling pines were beginning to show in the fields, and the house was sagging and untidy. Kathleen was thin and taut. The two of them, with their Yankee stepmother, their 4 little half-sisters, and Hilton, the Yankee overseer, remained in the silent, oddly echoing house. Scarlett had never liked Hilton, any more than she liked their own overseer, Jonas Wilkerson. And she liked him even less now, as he sauntered forward and greeted her like an equal. Formerly, he had the same combination of servility and impertinence which Wilkerson possessed, but now, with Mr. Calvert and Rayford dead in the war and Cade sick, he had dropped all servility. The second Mrs. Calvert had never known how to compel respect from Negro servants, and it was not to be expected that she could get it from a white man.
"Mr. Hilton has been so kind about staying with us through these difficult times," said Mrs. Calvert nervously, casting quick glances at her silent stepdaughter. "Very kind. I suppose you heard how he saved our house twice when Sherman was here. I'm sure I don't know how we would have managed without him, with no money, and Cade..." A flush went over Cade's white face, and Kathleen's long lashes veiled her eyes as her mouth hardened.
Scarlett knew their souls were writhing in helpless rage at being under obligations to their Yankee overseer. Mrs. Calvert seemed ready to weep. She had somehow made a blunder. She was always blundering. She just couldn't understand Southerners, for all that she had lived in Georgia 20 years. She never knew what not to say to her stepchildren, and no matter what she said or did, they were always so exquisitely polite to her. Silently she vowed she would go north to her own people, taking her children with her, and leave these puzzling, stiff-necked strangers. After these visits, Scarlett had no desire to see the Tarletons. Now that the four boys were gone, the house burned and the family cramped in the overseer's cottage, she could not bring herself to go. But Sue Ellen and Corrine begged, and Melanie said it would be unneighborly not to call and welcome Mr. Tarleton back from the war. So one Sunday, they went. This was the worst of all. As they drove up by the ruins of the house, they saw Beatrice Tarleton dressed in a worn riding habit, a crop under her arm, sitting on the top rail of the fence about the paddock, staring moodily at nothing. Beside her perched the bow-legged little Negro who had trained her horses, and he looked as glum as his mistress. The paddock, once full of frolicking colts and placid brood mares, was empty now except for one mule, the mule Mr. Tarleton had ridden home from the surrender. "I swear I don't know what to do with myself now that my darlings are gone," said Mrs. Tarleton, climbing down from the fence. A stranger might have thought she spoke of her four dead sons, but the girls from Tara knew her horses were in her mind. "All my beautiful horses dead. And, oh, my poor Nellie. If I just had Nellie, and nothing but a damned mule on the place. A damned mule," she repeated, looking indignantly at the scrawny beast. "It's an insult to the memory of my blooded darlings to have a mule in their paddock. Mules are misbegotten, unnatural critters, and it ought to be illegal to breed them." Jim Tarleton, completely disguised by a bushy beard, came out of the overseer's house to welcome and kiss the girls, and his four red-haired daughters in mended dresses streamed out behind him, tripping over the dozen black-and-tan hounds which ran barking to the door at the sound of strange voices. There was an air of studied and determined cheerfulness about the whole family, which brought a colder chill to Scarlett's bones than the bitterness of mimosa or the deathly brooding of pine bloom. The Tarletons insisted that the girls stay for dinner, saying they had so few guests these days and wanted to hear all the news. Scarlett didn't want to linger, for the atmosphere oppressed her. But Melanie and her two sisters were anxious for a longer visit, so the four stayed for dinner and ate sparingly of the side meat and dried peas which were served them. There was laughter about the skimpy fare, and the Tarleton girls giggled as they told of makeshifts for clothes, as if they were telling the most amusing of jokes. Melanie met them halfway, surprising Scarlet with her unexpected vivacity as she told of trials at Terra, making light of hardships. Scarlet could hardly speak at all. The room seemed so empty without the four great Tarleton boys, lounging and smoking and teasing. And if it seemed empty to her, what must it seem to the Tarletons, who were offering a smiling front to their neighbors? Corinne had said little during the meal, but when it was over, she slipped over to Mrs. Tarleton's side and whispered something. Mrs. Tarleton's face changed, and the brittle smile left her lips as she put her arm around Corinne's slender waist. They left the room, and Scarlet, who felt she could not endure the house another minute, followed them. They went down the path to the garden, and Scarlet saw they were going toward the burying ground. Well, she couldn't go back to the house now. It would seem too rude. But what on earth did Corinne mean dragging Mrs. Tarleton out to the boys' graves when Beatrice was trying so hard to be brave? There were two new marble markers in the brick-enclosed lot under the funereal cedars. So new that no rain had splashed them with red dust. "We got them last week," said Mrs. Tarleton proudly. "Mr. Tarleton went to Macon and brought them home in the wagon." Tombstones! And what they must have cost! Suddenly, Scarlet didn't feel as sorry for the Tarletons as she had at first. Anybody who would waste precious money on tombstones when food was so dear, so almost unattainable, didn't deserve sympathy. And there were several lines carved on each of the stones. The more carving, the more money. The whole family must be crazy. And it had cost money, too, to bring the three boys' bodies home. They had never found Boyd or any trace of him. Between the graves of Brent and Stuart was a stone which read, "They were lovely and pleasant in their lives, and in their death they were not divided." On the other stone were the names of Boyd and Tom, with something in Latin which began, "Dulce et," but it meant nothing to Scarlet, who had managed to evade Latin at the Fayetteville Academy. All that money for tombstones! Why, they were fools! She felt as indignant as if her own money had been squandered. Corinne's eyes were shining oddly.
"I think it's lovely," she whispered, pointing to the first stone.
Corinne would think it lovely. Anything sentimental stirred her.
"Yes," said Mrs. Tarleton, and her voice was soft. "We thought it very fitting. They died almost at the same time, Stuart first, and then Brent, who caught up the flag he dropped."
As the girls drove back to Terra, Scarlet was silent for a while, thinking of what she had seen in the various homes, remembering against her will the county in its glory, with visitors at all the big houses and money plentiful, Negroes crowding the quarters, and the well-tended fields glorious with cotton.
"In another year, there'll be little pines all over these fields," she thought. And looking toward the encircling forest, she shuddered. "Without the darkies, it will be all we can do to keep body and soul together. Nobody can run a big plantation without darkies. And lots of the fields won't be cultivated at all, and the woods will take over the fields again. Nobody can plant much cotton. And what will we do then? What will become of country folks?
Town folks can manage somehow. They've always managed. But we country folks will go back 100 years, like the pioneers who had little cabins and just scratched a few acres, and barely existed." "No," she thought grimly. "Terra isn't going to be like that. Not even if I have to plow myself. This whole section, this whole state can go back to woods if it wants to, but I won't let Terra go. And I don't intend to waste my money on tombstones or my time crying about the war. We can make out somehow. I know we could make out somehow if the men weren't all dead. Losing the darkies isn't the worst part about this. It's the loss of the men. The young men. She thought again of the four Tarltons, and Joe Fontaine, of Rayford Calvert, and the Monroe brothers, and all the boys from Fayetteville and Jonesboro, whose names she had read on the casualty lists. If there were just enough men left, we could manage somehow, but... Another thought struck her. Suppose she wanted to marry again. Of course, she didn't want to marry again. Once was certainly enough. Besides, the only man she'd ever wanted was Ashley, and he was married, if he was still living. But suppose she should want to marry. Who would there be to marry her? The thought was appalling. "Mellie," she said, "what's going to happen to Southern girls?"
"What do you mean?"
"Just what I say. What's going to happen to them? There's no one to marry them. Why, Mellie, with all the boys dead, there'll be thousands of girls all over the South who'll die old maids."
"And never have any children," added Melanie, to whom this was the most important thing.
Evidently, the thought wasn't new to Sue Ellen, who sat in the back of the wagon, for she suddenly began to cry. She hadn't heard from Frank Kennedy since Christmas. She didn't know if the lack of mail service was the cause, or if he had merely trifled with her affections and then forgotten her. Or maybe he had been killed in the last days of the war. The latter would have been infinitely preferable to his forgetting her, for at least there was some dignity about a dead love, such as Corrine and India Wilkes had, but none about a deserted fiancée.
"Oh, in the name of God, hush!" said Scarlet.
"Oh, you can talk," sobbed Sue Ellen, "because you've been married and had a baby, and everybody knows some man wanted you. But look at me. And you've got to be mean and throw it up to me that I'm an old maid when I can't help myself. I think you're hateful."
"Oh, hush. You know how I hate people who bawl all the time. You know perfectly well old Ginger Whiskers isn't dead, and that he'll come back and marry you. He hasn't any better sense. But personally, I'd rather be an old maid than marry him."
There was silence from the back of the wagon for a while, and Corrine comforted her sister with absent-minded pats. For her mind was a long way off, riding paths 3 years old with Brent Tarleton beside her. There was a glow, an exultation in her eyes.
"Ah," said Melanie sadly, "what will the South be like without all our fine boys? What would the South have been if they had lived? We could use their courage and their energy and their brains. Scarlet, all of us with little boys must raise them to take the places of the men who are gone, to be brave men like them."
"There will never again be men like them," said Corrine softly. "No one can take their places." They drove home the rest of the way in silence. One day, not long after this, Kathleen Calvert rode up to Tara at sunset. Her side saddle was strapped on as sorry a mule as Scarlet had ever seen, a flop-eared, lame brute. And Kathleen was almost as sorry-looking as the animal she rode. Her dress was a faded gingham of the type once worn only by house servants, and her sunbonnet was secured under her chin by a piece of twine. She rode up to the front porch, but did not dismount. And Scarlet and Melanie, who had been watching the sunset, went down the steps to meet her. Kathleen was as white as Cade had been the day Scarlet called, white and hard and brittle, as if her face would shatter if she spoke. But her back was erect, and her head was high as she nodded to them. Scarlet suddenly remembered the day of the Wilkes barbecue when she and Kathleen had whispered together about Rhett Butler. How pretty and fresh Kathleen had been that day, in a swirl of blue organdy with fragrant roses at her sash, and little black velvet slippers laced about her small ankles. And now there was not a trace of that girl in the stiff figure sitting on the mule.
"I won't get down, thank you," she said. "I just came to tell you that I'm going to be married."
"What? Who to?"
"Kathy, how grand! When?"
"Tomorrow," said Kathleen quietly. And there was something in her voice which took the eager smiles from their faces.
"I came to tell you that I'm going to be married tomorrow in Jonesboro, and I'm not inviting you all to come."
They digested this in silence, looking up at her puzzled. Then Melanie spoke. "Is it someone we know, dear?"
"Yes," said Kathleen shortly. "It's Mr. Hilton."
"Mr. Hilton?"
"Yes, Mr. Hilton, our overseer." Scarlett could not even find voice to say, "Oh!" But Kathleen, peering down suddenly at Melanie, said in a low, savage voice, "If you cry, Melly, I can't stand it. I shall die." Melanie said nothing but patted the foot in its awkward homemade shoe, which hung from the stirrup. Her head was low.
"And don't pet me. I can't stand that either."
Melanie dropped her hand, but still did not look up.
"Well, I must go. I only came to tell you."
The white, brittle mask was back again, and she picked up the reins.
"How is Cade?"
asked Scarlett, utterly at a loss, but fumbling for some words to break the awkward silence.
"He is dying," said Kathleen shortly. There seemed to be no feeling in her voice. "And he is going to die in some comfort and peace if I can manage it, without worry about who will take care of me when he's gone. You see, my stepmother and the children are going north for good tomorrow."
"Well, I must be going."
Melanie looked up and met Kathleen's hard eyes. There were bright tears on Melanie's lashes and understanding in her eyes, and before them, Kathleen's lips curved into the crooked smile of a brave child who tries not to cry. It was all very bewildering to Scarlett, who was still trying to grasp the idea that Kathleen Calvert was going to marry an overseer. Kathleen, daughter of a rich planter. Kathleen, who next to Scarlett had had more beaux than any girl in the county. Kathleen bent down, and Melanie tiptoed. They kissed. Then Kathleen flapped the bridle rein sharply, and the old mule moved off. Melanie looked after her, the tears streaming down her face. Scarlett stared, still dazed.
"Melly, is she crazy? You know she can't be in love with him."
"In love? Oh, Scarlett, don't even suggest such a horrid thing. Oh, poor Kathleen. Poor Cade."
"Fiddle-dee-dee," cried Scarlett, beginning to be irritated. It was annoying that Melanie always seemed to grasp more of situations than she herself did. Kathleen's plight seemed to her more startling than catastrophic. Of course, it was no pleasant thought, marrying Yankee white trash. But after all, a girl couldn't live alone on a plantation. She had to have a husband to help her run it.
"Melly, it's like I said the other day. There isn't anybody for girls to marry, and they've got to marry someone."
"Oh, they don't have to marry. There's nothing shameful in being a spinster. Look at Aunt Pity. Oh, I'd rather see Kathleen dead. I know Cade would rather see her dead. It's the end of the Calverts. Just think what their children will be. Oh, Scarlett, have Pork saddle the horse quickly, and you ride after her, and tell her to come live with us."
"Good Lord!" cried Scarlett, shocked at the matter-of-fact way in which Melanie was offering Tara. Scarlett certainly had no intention of feeding another mouth. She started to say this, but
Something in Melanie's stricken face halted the words.
"She wouldn't come, Millie," she amended. "You know she wouldn't. She's so proud, and she'd think it was charity."
"That's true. That's true," said Melanie distractedly, watching the small cloud of red dust disappear down the road.
"You've been with me for months," thought Scarlett grimly, looking at her sister-in-law. "And it's never occurred to you that it's charity you're living on. And I guess it never will. You're one of those people the war didn't change, and you go right on thinking and acting just like nothing had happened. Like we were still rich as Croesus, and had more food than we knew what to do with, and guests didn't matter. I guess I've got you on my neck for the rest of my life. But I won't have Kathleen, too."
Chapter 30. In that warm summer after peace came, Terra suddenly lost its isolation. And for months thereafter, a stream of scarecrows, bearded, ragged, footsore, and always hungry, toiled up the red hill to Terra and came to rest on the shady front steps, wanting food and a night's lodging. They were Confederate soldiers walking home. The railroad had carried the remains of Johnston's army from North Carolina to Atlanta and dumped them there. And from Atlanta they began their pilgrimages afoot. When the wave of Johnston's men had passed, the weary veterans from the Army of Virginia arrived, and then men from the Western troops, beating their way south toward homes which might not exist and families which might be scattered or dead. Most of them were walking. A few fortunate ones rode bony horses and mules, which the terms of the surrender had permitted them to keep. Gaunt animals which even an untrained eye could tell would never reach far away Florida and South Georgia. Going home. Going home. That was the only thought in the soldiers' minds. Some were sad and silent, others gay and contemptuous of hardships. But the thought that it was all over and they were going home was the one thing that sustained them. Few of them were bitter. They left bitterness to their women and their old people. They had fought a good fight, had been licked, and were willing to settle down peaceably to plowing beneath the flag they had fought. Going home. Going home. They could talk of nothing else, neither battles nor wounds, nor imprisonment, nor the future. Later, they would refight battles and tell children and grandchildren of pranks and forays and charges, of hunger, forced marches and wounds, but not now. Some of them lacked an arm or a leg or an eye. Many had scars which would ache in rainy weather if they lived for 70 years. But these seemed small matters now. Later, it would be different. Old and young, talkative and taciturn, rich planter and sallow cracker, they all had two things in common, lice and dysentery. The Confederate soldier was so accustomed to his verminous state, he didn't give it a thought, and scratched unconcernedly even in the presence of ladies. As for dysentery, the bloody flux, as the ladies delicately called it, it seemed to have spared no one from private to general. 4 years of half-starvation, 4 years of rations which were coarse or green or half-putrefied, had done its work with them, and every soldier who stopped at Terra was either just recovering or was actively suffering from it. "Dey ain't a sound set of bowels in de whole Confederate army," observed Mammy darkly as she sweated over the fire, brewing a bitter concoction of blackberry roots which had been Ellen's sovereign remedy for such afflictions. "It's my notion dat 'twarn't de Yankees what beat our gentlemen. 'Twas de own innards. Can't no gentleman fight with his bowels turning to water." One and all, Mammy dosed them,
Never waiting to ask foolish questions about the state of their organs, and one and all, they drank her doses meekly and with wry faces, remembering, perhaps, other stern black faces in far-off places, and other inexorable black hands holding medicine spoons. In the matter of company, Mammy was equally adamant. No lice-ridden soldier should come into Terra. She marched them behind a clump of thick bushes, relieved them of their uniforms, gave them a basin of water and strong lye soap to wash with, and provided them with quilts and blankets to cover their nakedness, while she boiled their clothing in her huge wash pot. It was useless for the girls to argue hotly that such conduct humiliated the soldiers. Mammy replied that the girls would be a sight more humiliated if they found lice upon themselves. When the soldiers began arriving almost daily, Mammy protested against their being allowed to use the bedrooms. Always she feared lest some louse had escaped her. Rather than argue the matter, Scarlet turned the parlor with its deep velvet rug into a dormitory. Mammy cried out equally loudly at the sacrilege of soldiers being permitted to sleep on Miss Ellen's rug. But Scarlet was firm. They had to sleep somewhere. And in the months after the surrender, the deep, soft nap began to show signs of wear. And finally the heavy warp and woof showed through in spots where heels had worn it and spurs dug carelessly. Of each soldier, they asked eagerly of Ashley. Sue Ellen, bridling, always asked news of Mr. Kennedy. But none of the soldiers had ever heard of them, nor were they inclined to talk about the missing. It was enough that they themselves were alive, and they didn't care to think of the thousands in unmarked graves who would never come home. The family tried to bolster Melanie's courage after each of these disappointments. Of course Ashley hadn't died in prison. Some Yankee chaplain would have written if this were true. Of course he was coming home, but his prison was so far away. Why, goodness, it took days riding on a train to make the trip, and if Ashley was walking like these men... Why hadn't he written? Well, darling, you know what the mails are now. So uncertain and slipshod, even where mail routes are re-established. But suppose he had died on the way home. Now, Melanie, some Yankee woman would have surely written us about it. Yankee women? Bah! Melly, there are some nice Yankee women. Oh, yes, there are. God couldn't make a whole nation without having some nice women in it. Scarlet, you remember we did meet a nice Yankee woman at Saratoga that time. Scarlet, tell Melly about her. Nice my foot, replied Scarlet. She asked me how many bloodhounds we kept to chase our darkies with. I agree with Melly. I never saw a nice Yankee male or female. But don't cry, Melly. Ashley'll come home. It's a long walk, and maybe he hasn't got any boots. Then at the thought of Ashley barefooted, Scarlet could have cried. Let other soldiers limp by in rags with their feet tied up in sacks and strips of carpet, but not Ashley. He should come home on a prancing horse, dressed in fine clothes and shining boots, a plume in his hat. It was the final degradation for her to think of Ashley reduced to the state of these other soldiers. One afternoon in June, when everyone at Terra was assembled on the back porch, eagerly watching Pork cut the first half-ripe watermelon of the season, they heard hooves on the gravel of the front drive. Prissy started languidly toward the front door, while those left behind argued hotly as to whether they should hide the melon or keep it for supper. Should the caller at the door prove to be a soldier? Melly and Corrine whispered that the soldier guest should have a share, and Scarlet, backed by Sue Ellen and Mammy, hissed to Pork to hide it quickly. "Don't be a goose, girls. There's not enough for us as it is. And if there are two or three famished soldiers out there, none of us will even get a taste," said Scarlet. While Pork stood with a little melon clutched to him, uncertain as to the final decision, they heard Prissy cry out.
God almighty! Miss Scarlet! Miss Melly! Come quick!
Who is it? Cried Scarlet, leaping up from the steps and racing through the hall with Melly at her shoulder and the others streaming after her.
Ashley, she thought. Or perhaps... It's Uncle Peter! Miss Pitapat's Uncle Peter!
They all ran out to the front porch and saw the tall, grizzled old despot of Aunt Pitty's house climbing down from a rat-tailed nag on which a section of quilting had been strapped. On his wide black face, accustomed dignity strove with delight at seeing old friends, with the result that his brow was furrowed in a frown, but his mouth was hanging open like a happy, toothless old hound's. Everyone ran down the steps to greet him, black and white shaking his hand and asking questions, but Melly's voice rose above them all.
Auntie isn't sick, is she?
No'm. She's poorly, thank God,
answered Peter, fastening a severe look first on Melly and then on Scarlet, so that they suddenly felt guilty, but could think of no reason why.
She's poorly, but she's plumb outdone with you young misses, and if it come right down to it, I is too.
Why, Uncle Peter, what on earth?
Y'all needn't try to excuse yourselves. Ain't Miss Pitty writ you to come home? Ain't I seed her right and seed her a-crying when y'all writ her back that you got too much to do on dish yer old farm to come home?
But, Uncle Peter,
how come you leave Miss Pitty by herself like this when she's so scary-like? You know as well as I do Miss Pitty ain't never lived by herself, and she been shaking in her little shoes ever since she come back from Macomb. She said for me to tell y'all plain as I knows how that she just can't understand y'all deserting her in her hour of need.
Now, hush, said Mammy tartly, for it sat ill upon her to hear Tara referred to as an old farm.
Trust an ignorant city-bred darky not to know the difference between a farm and a plantation.
Ain't us got no hours of need? Ain't us needin' Miss Scarlet and Miss Melly right here, and needin' them bad? How come Miss Pitty don't ask her brother for assistance? Does she need any?
Uncle Peter gave her a withering look.
Us ain't had nothin' to do with Mr. Henry for years, and us is too old to start now.
He turned back to the girls, who were trying to suppress their smiles.
You young misses ought to take shame. Leaving poor Miss Pitty alone, with half her friends dead and the other half in Macomb, and Atlanta full of Yankee soldiers and trashy free-issue niggers.
The two girls had borne the castigation with straight faces as long as they could. But the thought of Aunt Pitty sending Peter to scold them and bring them back bodily to Atlanta was too much for their control. They burst into laughter and hung on each other's shoulders for support. Naturally, Pork and Dilsey and Mammy gave vent to loud guffaws at hearing the detractor of their beloved Tara set at naught. Sue Ellen and Corrine giggled, and even Gerald's face wore a vague smile. Everyone laughed except Peter, who shifted from one large splayed foot to the other in mounting indignation.
"What's wrong with you, nigger?"
inquired Mammy with a grin.
"Is you getting too old to protect your own missus?"
Peter was outraged.
"Too old? Me too old? No, ma'am. I can protect Miss Pitty like I always done. Ain't I protect her down to Macomb when us refugeed? Ain't I protect her when the Yankees come to Macomb and she's so scared she fainting all the time? And ain't I acquired this year nag to bring her back to Atlanta and protect her and her pa's silver all the way?"
Peter drew himself to his full height as he vindicated himself.
"I ain't talking about protecting. I's talking about how it look."
"How who look?"
"I'm talking about how it looks to folks seeing Miss Pitty living alone. Folks talk scandalous about maiden ladies that lives by theirself,"
continued Peter,
and it was obvious to his listeners that Pitypat, in his mind, was still a plump and charming miss of 16 who must be sheltered against evil tongues.
"And I ain't figuring on having folks criticize her.
No, ma'am.
And I ain't figuring on her taking in no boarders just for company, neither. I done told her that. Not while you got your flesh and blood that belongs with you," I says. "And now her flesh and blood denying her. Miss Pity ain't nothing but a child, and..."
At this, Scarlet and Melly whooped louder and sank down to the steps. Finally, Melly wiped tears of mirth from her eyes.
"Poor Uncle Peter. I'm sorry," I laughed, "really and truly. There, do forgive me.
Miss Scarlet and I just can't come home now. Maybe I'll come in September after the cotton is picked. Did Auntie send you all the way down here just to bring us back on that bag of bones?" At this question, Peter's jaw suddenly dropped, and guilt and consternation swept over his wrinkled black face. His protruding underlip retreated to normal as swiftly as a turtle withdraws his head beneath its shell.
"Miss Melly, I's getting old, I specs, 'cause I clean forget for the moment what she sent me for, and it's important, too. I got a letter for you. Miss Pity wouldn't trust the mails or nobody but me to bring it, and
a letter? For me? Who from?"
"Well, it's Miss Pity, she says to me, 'You, Peter, you break it gently to Miss Melly,' and I say..."
Melly rose from the steps, her hand at her heart.
"Ashley, Ashley, he's dead."
"No'm, no'm,"
cried Peter, his voice rising to a shrill bawl as he fumbled in the breast pocket of his ragged coat.
"He's alive. Dis yer a letter from him. He comin' home. He... God almighty, catch him, mammy. Let me..."
"Don't you touch her, you old fool,"
thundered Mammy, struggling to keep Melanie's sagging body from falling to the ground.
"You pious black ape. Break it gently. You, Poke, take a feet. Miss Corrine, steady her head. Let's us lay her on the sofa in the parlor."
There was a tumult of sound as everyone but Scarlet swarmed about the fainting Melanie, everyone crying out in alarm, scurrying into the house for water and pillows, and in a moment Scarlet and Uncle Peter were left standing alone on the walk. She stood rooted, unable to move from the position to which she had leaped when she heard his words, staring at the old man who stood feebly waving a letter. His old black face was as pitiful as a child's under its mother's disapproval. His dignity collapsed. For a moment, she couldn't speak or move, and though her mind shouted, "He isn't dead, he's coming home," the knowledge brought neither joy nor excitement, only a stunned immobility. Uncle Peter's voice came as from a far distance, plaintive, placating.
"Mr. Willie Burr from Macomb, what is kin to us, he brung it to Miss Pity. Mr. Willie, he in the same jailhouse with Mr. Ashley. Mr. Willie, he got a horse, and he got here soon. But Mr. Ashley, he a-walkin', and..."
Scarlet snatched the letter from his hand. It was addressed to Melly in Miss Pity's writing, but that didn't make her hesitate a moment. She ripped it open, and Miss Pity's enclosed note fell to the ground. Within the envelope, there was a piece of folded paper, grimy from the dirty pocket in which it had been carried, creased and ragged about the edges. It bore the inscription in Ashley's hand, "Mrs. George Ashley Wilkes, care Miss Sarah Jane Hamilton, Atlanta or 12 Oaks, Jonesboro, Georgia." With fingers that shook, she opened it and read, "Beloved, I am coming home to you." Tears began to stream down her face, so that she couldn't read, and her heart swelled up until she felt she could not bear the joy of it. Clutching the letter to her,
She raced up the porch steps and down the hall, past the parlor where all the inhabitants of Terra were getting in one another's way as they worked over the unconscious Melanie, and into Ellen's office. She shut the door and locked it, and flung herself down on the sagging old sofa, crying, laughing, kissing the letter. "Beloved," she whispered, "I am coming home to you." Common sense told them that unless Ashley developed wings, it would be weeks or even months before he could travel from Illinois to Georgia. But hearts nevertheless beat wildly whenever a soldier turned into the avenue at Terra. Each bearded scarecrow might be Ashley. And if it weren't Ashley, perhaps the soldier would have news of him or a letter from Aunt Pity about him. Black and white, they rushed to the front porch every time they heard footsteps. The sight of a uniform was enough to bring everyone flying from the woodpile, the pasture, and the cotton patch. For a month after the letter came, work was almost at a standstill. No one wanted to be out of the house when he arrived, Scarlet least of all. And she couldn't insist on the others attending to their duties when she so neglected hers. But when the weeks crawled by, and Ashley did not come or any news of him, Terra settled back into its old routine. Longing hearts could only stand so much of longing. An uneasy fear crept into Scarlet's mind that something had happened to him along the way. Rock Island was so far away, and he might have been weak or sick when released from prison. And he had no money, and was tramping through a country where Confederates were hated. If only she knew where he was, she would send money to him. Send every penny she had, and let the family go hungry, so he could come home swiftly on the train. "Beloved, I am coming home to you." In the first rush of joy when her eyes met those words, they had meant only that Ashley was coming home to her. Now, in the light of cooler reason, it was Melanie to whom he was returning. Melanie, who went about the house these days singing with joy. Occasionally, Scarlet wondered bitterly why Melanie couldn't have died in childbirth in Atlanta. That would have made things perfect. Then she could have married Ashley after a decent interval and made little Beau a good stepmother, too. When such thoughts came, she didn't pray hastily to God, telling him she didn't mean it. God didn't frighten her anymore. Soldiers came singly and in pairs and dozens, and they were always hungry. Scarlet thought despairingly that a plague of locusts would be more welcome. She cursed again the old custom of hospitality which had flowered in the era of plenty, the custom which would not permit any traveler, great or humble, to go on his journey without a night's lodging, food for himself and his horse, and the utmost courtesy the house could give. She knew that era had passed forever. But the rest of the household didn't, nor did the soldiers. And each soldier was welcomed as if he were a long-awaited guest. As the never-ending line went by, her heart hardened. They were eating the food meant for the mouths of Terra, vegetables over whose long rows she had wearied her back, food she had driven endless miles to buy. Food was so hard to get, and the money in the Yankee's wallet wouldn't last forever. Only a few greenbacks, and the 2 gold pieces were left now. Why should she feed this horde of hungry men? The war was over. They would never again stand between her and danger. So she gave orders to Pork that when soldiers were in the house, the table should be set sparely. This order prevailed until she noticed that Melanie, who had never been strong since Beau was born, was inducing Pork to put only dabs of food on her plate and giving her share to the soldiers. "You'll have to stop it, Melanie," she scolded. "You're half sick yourself, and if you don't eat more, you'll be sick in bed and we'll have to nurse you. Let these men go hungry. They can stand it.
They've stood it for 4 years, and it won't hurt them to stand it a little while longer.
Melanie turned to her, and on her face was the first expression of naked emotion Scarlet had ever seen in those serene eyes.
"Oh, Scarlet, don't scold me. Let me do it. You don't know how it helps me. Every time I give some poor man my share, I think that maybe, somewhere on the road up north, some woman is giving my Ashley a share of her dinner. And it's helping him to get home to me.
My Ashley. Beloved, I am coming home to you." Scarlet turned away, wordless. After that, Melanie noticed there was more food on the table when guests were present, even though Scarlet might grudge them every mouthful. When the soldiers were too ill to go on, and there were many such, Scarlet put them to bed with none too good grace. Each sick man meant another mouth to feed. Someone had to nurse him, and that meant one less worker at the business of fence-building, hoeing, weeding, and plowing. One boy, on whose face a blonde fuzz had just begun to sprout, was dumped on the front porch by a mounted soldier bound for Fayetteville. He had found him unconscious by the roadside and had brought him across his saddle to Terra, the nearest house. The girls thought he must be one of the little cadets who had been called out of military school when Sherman approached Milledgeville, but they never knew, for he died without regaining consciousness. And a search of his pockets yielded no information. A nice-looking boy, obviously a gentleman. And somewhere to the south, some woman was watching the roads, wondering where he was and when he was coming home, just as she and Melanie, with a wild hope in their hearts, watched every bearded figure that came up their walk. They buried the cadet in the family burying ground, next to the three little O'Hara boys, and Melanie cried sharply as Pork filled in the grave, wondering in her heart if strangers were doing this same thing to the tall body of Ashley. Will Benteen was another soldier, like the nameless boy, who arrived unconscious across the saddle of a comrade. Will was acutely ill with pneumonia, and when the girls put him to bed, they feared he would soon join the boy in the burying ground. He had the sallow malarial face of the South Georgia cracker, pale pinkish hair and washed-out blue eyes which even in delirium were patient and mild. One of his legs was gone at the knee, and to the stump was fitted a roughly whittled wooden peg. He was obviously a cracker, just as the boy they had buried so short a while ago was obviously a planter's son. Just how the girls knew this, they couldn't say. Certainly Will was no dirtier, no more hairy, no more lice-infested than many fine gentlemen who came to Terra. Certainly the language he used in his delirium was no less grammatical than that of the Tarleton twins. But they knew instinctively, as they knew thoroughbred horses from scrubs, that he was not of their class. But this knowledge did not keep them from laboring to save him. Emaciated from a year in a Yankee prison, exhausted by his long tramp on his ill-fitting wooden peg, he had little strength to combat pneumonia, and for days he lay in the bed moaning, trying to get up, fighting battles over again. Never once did he call for mother, wife, sister, or sweetheart. And this omission worried Corrine. "A man ought to have some folks," she said. "And he sounds like he didn't have a soul in the world." For all his lankiness, he was tough, and good nursing pulled him through. The day came when his pale blue eyes, perfectly cognizant of his surroundings, fell upon Corrine sitting beside him, telling her rosary beads, the morning sun shining through her fair hair. "Then you weren't a dream after all," he said, in his flat, toneless voice. "I hope I ain't troubled you too much, ma'am." His convalescence was a long one,
and he lay quietly looking out of the window at the magnolias, and causing very little trouble to anyone. Corinne liked him because of his placid and unembarrassed silences. She would sit beside him through the long, hot afternoons, fanning him and saying nothing. Corinne had very little to say these days, as she moved, delicate and wraith-like, about the tasks which were within her strength. She prayed a good deal, for when Scarlett came into her room without knocking, she always found her on her knees by her bed. The sight never failed to annoy her, for Scarlett felt that the time for prayer had passed. If God had seen fit to punish them so, then God could very well do without prayers. Religion had always been a bargaining process with Scarlett. She promised God good behavior in exchange for favors. God had broken the bargain time and again, to her way of thinking, and she felt that she owed him nothing at all now. And whenever she found Corinne on her knees when she should have been taking an afternoon nap or doing the mending, she felt that Corinne was shirking her share of the burdens. She said as much to Will Benteen one afternoon when he was able to sit up in a chair, and was startled when he said, in his flat voice, "Let her be, Miss Scarlett. It comforts her."
"Comforts her?"
"Yes. She's praying for your ma and him."
"Who is him?"
His faded blue eyes looked at her from under sandy lashes without surprise. Nothing seemed to surprise or excite him. Perhaps he had seen too much of the unexpected ever to be startled again. That Scarlett didn't know what was in her sister's heart did not seem odd to him. He took it as naturally as he did the fact that Corinne had found comfort in talking to him, a stranger.
"Her beau. That boy Brent something or other who was killed at Gettysburg."
"Her beau?" said Scarlett shortly. "Her beau, nothing. He and his brother were my beaus."
"Yes, so she told me. Looks like most of the county was your beaus. But all the same, he was her beau after you turned him down, because when he come home on his last furlough, they got engaged. She said he was the only boy she ever cared about, and so it kind of comforts her to pray for him."
"Well, fiddle-dee," said Scarlett, a very small dart of jealousy entering her.
She looked curiously at this lanky man, with his bony stooped shoulders, his pinkish hair and calm, unwavering eyes. So he knew things about her own family which she had not troubled to discover. So that was why Corinne mooned about, praying all the time. Well, she'd get over it. Lots of girls got over dead sweethearts, yes, dead husbands, too. She'd certainly gotten over Charles. And she knew one girl in Atlanta who had been widowed 3 times by the war and was still able to take notice of men. She said as much to Will, but he shook his head.
"Not Miss Corinne," he said with finality.
Will was pleasant to talk to, because he had so little to say, and yet was so understanding a listener. She told him about her problems of weeding and hoeing and planting, of fattening the hogs and breeding the cow, and he gave good advice, for he had owned a small farm in South Georgia and 2 Negroes. He knew his slaves were free now, and the farm gone to weeds and seedling pines. His sister, his only relative, had moved to Texas with her husband years ago, and he was alone in the world. Yet none of these things seemed to bother him any more than the leg he had left in Virginia. Yes, Will was a comfort to Scarlett after hard days when the Negroes muttered and Sue Ellen nagged and cried, and Gerald asked too frequently where Ellen was. She could tell Will anything. She even told him of killing the Yankee and glowed with pride when he commented briefly,
"Good work."
Eventually, all the family found their way to Will's room to air their troubles. Even Mammy,
who had at first been distant with him because he was not quality and had owned only 2 slaves. When he was able to totter about the house, he turned his hands to weaving baskets of split oak and mending the furniture ruined by the Yankees. He was clever at whittling, and Wade was constantly by his side, for he whittled out toys for him. The only toys the little boy had. With Will in the house, everyone felt safe in leaving Wade and the 2 babies while they went about their tasks, for he could care for them as deftly as Mammy, and only Melly surpassed him at soothing the screaming black and white babies.
"You've been mighty good to me, Miss Scarlet," he said. "And me a stranger, and nothing to you all. I've caused you a heap of trouble and worry, and if it's all the same to you, I'm going to stay here and help you all with the work, till I've paid you back some for your trouble. I can't ever pay it all, 'cause there ain't no payment a man can give for his life."
So he stayed. And gradually, unobtrusively, a large part of the burden of Tara shifted from Scarlet's shoulders to the bony shoulders of Will Benteen. It was September, and time to pick the cotton. Will Benteen sat on the front steps at Scarlet's feet in the pleasant sunshine of the early autumn afternoon, and his flat voice went on and on languidly about the exorbitant costs of ginning the cotton at the new gin near Fayetteville. However, he had learned that day in Fayetteville that he could cut this expense a fourth by lending the horse and wagon for 2 weeks to the gin owner. He had delayed closing the bargain until he discussed it with Scarlet. She looked at the lank figure leaning against the porch column, chewing a straw. Undoubtedly, as Mammy frequently declared, Will was something the Lord had provided, and Scarlet often wondered how Tara could have lived through the last few months without him. He never had much to say, never displayed any energy, never seemed to take much interest in anything that went on about him. But he knew everything about everybody at Tara. And he did things. He did them silently, patiently and competently. Though he had only one leg, he could work faster than pork. And he could get work out of pork, which was to Scarlet a marvelous thing. When the cow had the colic and the horse fell ill with a mysterious ailment which threatened to remove him permanently from them, Will sat up nights with them and saved them. That he was a shrewd trader brought him Scarlet's respect, for he could ride out in the mornings with a bushel or 2 of apples, sweet potatoes, and other vegetables, and return with seeds, lengths of cloth, flour, and other necessities which she knew she could never have acquired, good trader though she was. He had gradually slipped into the status of a member of the family, and slept on a cot in the little dressing room off Gerald's room. He said nothing of leaving Tara, and Scarlet was careful not to question him, fearful that he might leave them. Sometimes she thought that if he were anybody and had any gumption, he would go home, even if he no longer had a home. But even with this thought, she would pray fervently that he would remain indefinitely. It was so convenient to have a man about the house. She thought, too, that if Corrine had the sense of a mouse, she would see that Will cared for her. Scarlet would have been eternally grateful to Will had he asked her for Corrine's hand. Of course, before the war, Will would certainly not have been an eligible suitor. He was not of the planter class at all, though he was not poor white. He was just plain Cracker, a small farmer, half-educated, prone to grammatical errors and ignorant of some of the finer manners the O'Haras were accustomed to in gentlemen. In fact, Scarlet wondered if he could be called a gentleman at all, and decided that he couldn't. Melanie hotly defended him, saying that anyone who had Will's kind heart and thoughtfulness of others was of gentle birth.
Scarlet knew that Ellen would have fainted at the thought of a daughter of hers marrying such a man. But now Scarlet had been by necessity forced too far away from Ellen's teachings to let that worry her. Men were scarce. Girls had to marry someone, and Tara had to have a man. But Corrine, deeper and deeper immersed in her prayer book, and every day losing more of her touch with the world of realities, treated Will as gently as a brother, and took him as much for granted as she did pork. If Corrine had any sense of gratitude to me for what I've done for her, she'd marry him and not let him get away from here, Scarlet thought indignantly. But no, she must spend her time mooning about a silly boy who probably never gave her a serious thought. So Will remained at Terra. For what reason, she didn't know. And she found his businesslike man-to-man attitude with her both pleasant and helpful. He was gravely deferential to the vague Gerald, but it was to Scarlet that he turned as the real head of the house. She gave her approval to the plan of hiring out the horse, even though it meant the family would be without any means of transportation temporarily. Sue Ellen would be especially grieved at this. Her greatest joy lay in going to Jonesboro or Fayetteville with Will when he drove over on business. Adorned in the assembled best of the family, she called on old friends, heard all the gossip of the county, and felt herself again Miss O'Hara of Terra. Sue Ellen never missed the opportunity to leave the plantation and give herself airs among people who didn't know she weeded the garden and made beds. Miss Fine Airs will just have to do without gadding for 2 weeks, thought Scarlet. And we'll have to put up with her nagging and her bawling. Melanie joined them on the veranda, the baby in her arms, and spreading an old blanket on the floor, set little Beau down to crawl. Since Ashley's letter, Melanie had divided her time between glowing, singing happiness, and anxious longing. But happy or depressed, she was too thin, too white. She did her share of the work uncomplainingly, but she was always ailing. Old Dr. Fontaine diagnosed her trouble as female complaint, and concurred with Dr. Mead in saying she should never have had Beau. And he said frankly that another baby would kill her.
"When I was over to Fayetteville today," said Will, "I found something right cute that I thought would interest you ladies, and I brought it home."
He fumbled in his back pants pocket and brought out the wallet of calico stiffened with bark, which Corrine had made him. From it he drew a Confederate bill. "If you think Confederate money is cute, Will, I certainly don't," said Scarlet shortly, for the very sight of Confederate money made her mad.
"We've got $3,000 of it in Pa's trunk this minute, and Mammy's after me to let her paste it over the holes in the attic walls so the draft won't get her, and I think I'll do it. Then it'll be good for something."
"Imperious Caesar, dead and turned to clay," said Melanie with a sad smile. "Don't do that, Scarlet. Keep it for Wade. He'd be proud of it some day."
"Well, I don't know nothing about Imperious Caesar," said Will patiently. "But what I've got is in line with what you've just said about Wade, Miss Melly. It's a poem, pasted on back of this bill. I know Miss Scarlet ain't much on poems, but I thought this might interest her."
He turned the bill over. On its back was pasted a strip of coarse brown wrapping paper, inscribed in pale, homemade ink. Will cleared his throat and read slowly and with difficulty. "The name is Lines on the Back of a Confederate Note," he said. "Representing nothing on God's earth now, and not in the waters below it. As the pledge of a nation that's passed away, keep it, dear friend, and show it." Show it to those who will lend an ear to the tale this trifle will tell of liberty, born of patriot's dream, of a storm-cradled nation that fell.
Oh, how beautiful, how touching, cried Melanie. Scarlet, you mustn't give the money to Mammy to paste in the attic. It's more than paper, just like the poem said, the pledge of a nation that's passed away.
Oh, Melly, don't be sentimental. Paper is paper, and we've got little enough of it. And I'm tired of hearing Mammy grumble about the cracks in the attic. I hope when Wade grows up I'll have plenty of greenbacks to give him instead of Confederate trash. Will, who had been enticing little Beau across the blanket with a bill during this argument, looked up, and shading his eyes glanced down the driveway.
"More company," he said, squinting in the sun. "Another soldier."
Scarlet followed his gaze and saw a familiar sight, a bearded man coming slowly up the avenue under the cedars, a man clad in a ragged mixture of blue and gray uniforms, head bowed tiredly, feet dragging slowly.
"I thought we were about through with soldiers," she said. "I hope this one isn't very hungry."
"He'll be hungry," said Will briefly.
Melanie rose. "I'd better tell Dilsey to set an extra plate," she said, "and warn Mammy not to get the poor thing's clothes off his back too abruptly, and—"
She stopped so suddenly that Scarlet turned to look at her. Melanie's thin hand was at her throat, clutching it as if it was torn with pain, and Scarlet could see the veins beneath the white skin throbbing swiftly. Her face went whiter, and her brown eyes dilated enormously. "She's going to faint," thought Scarlet, leaping to her feet and catching her arm. But in an instant, Melanie threw off her hand and was down the steps. Down the graveled path she flew, skimming lightly as a bird, her faded skirt streaming behind her, her arms outstretched. Then Scarlet knew the truth with the impact of a blow. She reeled back against an upright of the porch as the man lifted a face covered with a dirty blonde beard and stopped still, looking toward the house as if he was too weary to take another step. Her heart leaped and stopped, and then began racing, as Melly, with incoherent cries, threw herself into the dirty soldier's arms, and his head bent down toward hers. With rapture, Scarlet took two running steps forward, but was checked when Will's hand closed upon her skirt.
"Don't spoil it," he said quietly.
"Turn me loose, you fool! Turn me loose! It's Ashley!"
He did not relax his grip.
"After all, he's her husband, ain't he?"
Will asked calmly, and, looking down at him, in a confusion of joy and impotent fury, Scarlet saw in the quiet depths of his eyes understanding and pity. Part 4. Chapter 31. On a cold January afternoon in 1866, Scarlet sat in the office writing a letter to Aunt Pity, explaining in detail for the 10th time why neither she, Melanie, nor Ashley could come back to Atlanta to live with her. She wrote impatiently because she knew Aunt Pity would read no farther than the opening lines, and then write her again, wailing,
"But I'm afraid to live by myself."
Her hands were chilled, and she paused to rub them together and to scuff her feet deeper into the strip of old quilting wrapped about them. The soles of her slippers were practically gone, and were reinforced with pieces of carpet. The carpet kept her feet off the floor, but did little to keep them warm. That morning Will had taken the horse to Jonesboro to get him shod.
Scarlet thought grimly that things were indeed at a pretty pass. When horses had shoes and people's feet were as bare as yard dogs. She picked up her quill to resume her writing, but laid it down when she heard Will coming in at the back door. She heard the thump-thump of his wooden leg in the hall outside the office, and then he stopped. She waited for a moment for him to enter, and when he made no move, she called to him. He came in, his ears red from the cold, his pinkish hair awry, and stood looking down at her, a faintly humorous smile on his lips. "Miss Scarlet," he questioned, "just how much cash money have you got?"
"Are you going to try to marry me for my money, Will?" she asked somewhat crossly.
"No, ma'am. I just wanted to know." She stared at him inquiringly. Will didn't look serious, but then he never looked serious. However, she felt that something was wrong.
"I've got $10 in gold," she said. "The last of that Yankee's money."
"Well, ma'am, that won't be enough."
"Enough for what?"
"Enough for the taxes," he answered, and stumping over to the fireplace, he leaned down and held his red hands to the blaze.
"Taxes?" she repeated. "Name of God, Will! We've already paid the taxes."
"Yes'm. But they say you didn't pay enough. I heard about it today over to Jonesboro."
"But, Will, I can't understand. What do you mean?"
"Miss Scarlet, I sure hate to bother you with more trouble when you've had your share, but I've got to tell you. They say you ought to pay lots more taxes than you did. They're running the assessment up on Terra sky high. Higher than any in the county, I'll be bound."
"But they can't make us pay more taxes when we've already paid them once."
"Miss Scarlet, you don't never go to Jonesboro often, and I'm glad you don't. It ain't no place for a lady these days. But if you'd been there much, you'd know there's a mighty rough bunch of scallywags and Republicans and carpetbaggers been running things recently. They'd make you mad enough to pop. And then, too, niggers pushing white folks off the sidewalks and..."
"But what's that got to do with our taxes?"
"I'm getting to it, Miss Scarlet. For some reason, the rascals have hasted the taxes on Terra till you'd think it was a 1,000-bale place. After I heard about it, I sort of oozed round the barrooms picking up gossip, and I found out that somebody wants to buy in Terra cheap, at the sheriff's sale, if you can't pay the extra taxes. And everybody knows pretty well that you can't pay them. I don't know yet who it is wants this place. I couldn't find out. But I think that pusillanimous feller, Hilton, that married Miss Kathleen knows, 'cause he laughed kinda nasty when I tried to sound him out." Will sat down on the sofa and rubbed the stump of his leg. It ached in cold weather, and the wooden peg was neither well padded nor comfortable. Scarlet looked at him wildly. His manner was so casual when he was sounding the death knell of Tara. "Sold out at the sheriff's sale? Where would they all go? And Tara belonging to someone else? No, that was unthinkable." She had been so engrossed with the job of making Tara produce, she had paid little heed to what was going on in the world outside. Now that she had Will and Ashley to attend to whatever business she might have in Jonesboro and Fayetteville, she seldom left the plantation. And even as she had listened with deaf ears to her father's war talk in the days before the war came, so she had paid little heed to Will and Ashley's discussions around the table after supper about the beginnings of Reconstruction. Oh, of course she knew about the scallywags, Southerners who had turned Republican very profitably, and the carpetbaggers, those Yankees who came south like buzzards after the surrender, with all their worldly possessions in one carpet bag. And she had had a few unpleasant experiences with the Freedmen's Bureau. She had gathered also that some of the free Negroes were getting quite insolent,
This last she could hardly believe, for she had never seen an insolent Negro in her life. But there were many things which Will and Ashley had conspired to keep from her. The scourge of war had been followed by the worst scourge of Reconstruction. But the two men had agreed not to mention the more alarming details when they discussed the situation at home. And when Scarlett took the trouble to listen to them at all, most of what they said went in one ear and out the other. She had heard Ashley say that the South was being treated as a conquered province, and that vindictiveness was the dominant policy of the conquerors. But that was the kind of statement which meant less than nothing at all to Scarlett. Politics was men's business. She had heard Will say it looked to him like the North just wasn't aiming to let the South get on its feet again. Well, thought Scarlett, men always had to have something foolish to worry about. As far as she was concerned, the Yankees hadn't whipped her once, and they wouldn't do it this time. The thing to do was to work like the devil and stop worrying about the Yankee government. After all, the war was over. Scarlett didn't realize that all the rules of the game had been changed, and that honest labor could no longer earn its just reward. Georgia was virtually under martial law now. The Yankee soldiers garrisoned throughout the section, and the Freedmen's Bureau were in complete command of everything, and they were fixing the rules to suit themselves. This bureau, organized by the federal government to take care of the idle and excited ex-slaves, was drawing them from the plantations into the villages and cities by the thousands. The Bureau fed them while they loafed and poisoned their minds against their former owners. Gerald's old overseer, Jonas Wilkerson, was in charge of the local Bureau, and his assistant was Hilton, Kathleen Calvert's husband. These two industriously spread the rumor that the Southerners and Democrats were just waiting for a good chance to put the Negroes back into slavery, and that the Negroes' only hope of escaping this fate was the protection given them by the Bureau and the Republican Party. Wilkerson and Hilton